Hi, this is Karin Zissis of ASUA Online. On April 11th, voters in the neighboring countries of Ecuador and Peru will head to the polls. In Ecuador, which is holding a presidential runoff, it took more than a month to figure out which two candidates would face each other after an incredibly close February 1st round. And there may seem to be a gulf in the visions between rivals Andrés Arauz and Guillermo Lasso, but as the University of British Columbia's Dr. Grace Jaramillo tells my colleague, Chase Harrison, both are social conservatives. We learn about how the candidates are making plays for everything from young to discontented voters, and how TikTok is playing a role in the race. But first, we hear about general elections and the first-round presidential vote in Peru. More than a dozen candidates are in the running, and none commands more than 15% support, leaving doubts about who will make it to the June runoff. Alonso Gormendi, a PhD candidate at University College London and professor at Lima's Universidad del Pacífico, tells ASUA Online's Holly K. Sunderland what's troubling voters in a country that saw three different people hold the presidential reins in November 2020. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en Foco.
América Latina en Foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Okay, well, Alonso, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Holly. Thank you for having me.
So we know that on April 11th, Peruvians are planning to go head to the polls in general elections. They're going to vote in a first round election for president and vice president, as well as all of Congress and a few members to the Andean Congress. Right now, it's a very crowded field, about a dozen and a half candidates. No candidate is really polling above 15, 20%, maybe if you field out the blank votes and undecideds. But still, Yone Lescano is leading polls, and in some of the scenarios, runoff scenarios, he's projected to do pretty well against any possible second round candidates. But we also know polls are unreliable. So what would you say are some wild cards or some other factors that could really influence the race and the outcome, do you think?
Well, so I think the main problem right now is the lack of ability by the candidates to convince large sectors of the population. Like you said, no candidate has over 15%. So I think there's a big pocket of voters that are hoping for someone who is able to be a little bit more pragmatic, or I guess centrist, than the current offer. Because I believe that what Peruvian voters want is someone who will make their government, their state, work properly. I don't feel like there is a lot of demand for super radical change, either to the right or to the left. And people are mostly reacting out of fear for the other, for the opposite. So people who are voting for López Aliaga are very scared of Mendoza. People who are voting for Mendoza are very scared of López Aliaga. So I feel that what can still happen is someone might take advantage of that feeling and try to position themselves in the center. So far, the only one that's tried is George Forsyth. Everyone else has tried to steal votes from each other. Like Veronica Mendoza is trying to steal votes from Lescano. Hernando de Soto is trying to steal votes from López Aliaga. And I feel that's what's been going on for the entire process. And it's proven that that's not the way to get beyond 15%.
Mm-hmm. So then if we're looking at of sort of the spectrum. And I mean, Forsyth was leading, you know, early polls all last year for a while. He was kind of the leader. And then Lescano came in. If those are the two candidates who would make it into the runoff, or even in the first round, if voters are deciding between those two, what do you think might motivate a voter to vote for Lescano, and what might motivate someone to vote for Forsyth? What are their two biggest attractions?
Well, first of all, it is completely possible that it's not those two candidates, because there's a, I think it's like a sextuple tie in second place by statistical measurements. But in the scenario where it's Diony Lescano and George Forsyth, because we would be removing those candidates that are more on the extremes of the ideological spectrum in terms of ideological purity, you have a Lescano that is, he's clearly on the left of the spectrum, but he has said that he does not intend to be a radical Chavista or anything like that. He even says that he's not even Marxist. He's a bit of a hodgepodge ideologically. And so the hope of people who might settle for him is that he might be able to be Humala-ized. You know, like Humala got into the government as a much further left candidate than he ruled the country. So there's hope that he might be tamed and tempered. The problem with Lescano is his party and his party's associations. There's a lot of shady people there, including Manuel Merino, the former coup monger. And George Forsyth is a little bit more of a leap of faith, I guess, see what he does. He specifically does. But his team is made out of well-known progressive people that have a very large Twitter presence. So it would really be a decision between those who want to hope to trust in Forsyth's team, which is not something that Peruvian politics is known for. Like, the teams aren't necessarily the most stable things in Peruvian politics. And those who are hoping to manipulate a candidate for their own preference. So it would be an interesting match. I would not know who would win.
Yeah. I mean, when numbers are so low in polls, I mean, everything is within the margin of error. So you really just don't know. So especially when you have so many undecided voters, voters who say they're going to cast null votes. And so, yeah, I mean, we should talk about, I mean, in general in, I mean, I guess Latin America and probably the world, you know, there's talk of, oh, declining alliance to political parties. But I feel like Peruvians are particularly jaded in these matters. They have some of the lowest approvals of Congress. Even I know the Latino Barometro report that La Pop does a couple years ago found that in Latin America, Peruvians had some of the lowest levels of faith in democracy. I think about less than half said they sort of supported it. About a quarter said they were satisfied with democracy. And especially after the events, you know, you referred to them in November, Manuel Merino, as president of Congress, led an ouster of the then president, Martin Vizcarra, and he's from the same party, Popular Action, as Lescano. And that's a party that's been around for 65 years in, you know, a country where so many things are new. I'm curious to where the youth vote and younger voters are, because so many of those protests were led by younger voters, younger activists. Where do you get the sense that they are heading into this election? Where is the, is that momentum from last November still carried through to this moment? Or where is that discussion happening right now?
So I think within the generational divide in Peruvian politics, where the boomer generation and the Generation X are a little bit more, let's just say, on the quote-unquote anti-communist mentality because of their lived experience during the 80s and the shiny path, and they're more prone to voting for either a candidate they can manipulate or a candidate like López Aliaga. There is a similar second portion of the population between millennials and Generation Z, the Zoomers. And I would say that in that younger end of the spectrum, people are either in the I don't know who to vote for camp, or they are in the Veronica Mendoza camp. Much of that millennial vote, I would say, was represented in the Partido Morado and Julio Guzman. That deflated because of Julio Guzman being a terrible candidate. You mentioned Acción Popular, Popular Action, being a party that's been around for 60 years. It has and it hasn't, right? Because there's no real party politics in Peru. So parties vary their ideology radically from election to election. So there are younger people siding with this idea of Partido Morado, which is this idea that there's red and blue and you mix them and you get purple and everyone can be happy, right? Which is very attractive to a more pragmatic, older millennial spectrum. I guess we'll never know if Salvador del Solar would have been the person to, you know, get these people all together. But all those people that went marching in the streets are themselves divided.
Yeah, it's been, I mean, and it's hard to keep political momentum like that going for 6 months in a pandemic. And Salvador, you were referencing, was one of the leader of those protests in November. So I wanted to ask too, just because you're a constitutional expert and you mentioned Mendoza. So without speaking about her candidacy in particular, her main platform idea is the proposal to reform or rewrite Peru's constitution, which has been a sort of an idea that's catching waves. Chile will rewrite their constitution starting this year. What are your thoughts on that, on just that proposal? Obviously, we know there's been a lot of institutional instability, especially between the executive and legislative branches. Do you think a rewrite would be prudent, or do you think there should be another way to maybe improve the constitution in order to give the country more stability and governability?
Look, I think the Peruvian constitution needs not just touch-ups, but important reforms. We are basically existing in a parliamentary system right now. With enough votes, you can remove a president. There is a sense that what the constitution produced is insufficient for the demands of people. And I think, personally, I think there's a wrong reading of what changing the constitution means to people, because Veronica Mendoza sees it as an opportunity to refound the economic foundation of the country. I don't think that's what people object to. I think if you ask more in more detail, what people object to is the idea of having a state that doesn't work. Like, if you need the state for any reason in Peru, you have problems. If you need it for health, education, security, whatever it is, it will not work for you. You will have to get around the problems that the government creates for you. So that is what legal reform or constitutional reform should focus on, institutionality and making the state work better. Now, from a legal standpoint, though, and from a political standpoint, accepting that there is a need for important reform in the Constitution, I do fear the mechanism that is being chosen for this. From a legal point of view, because it's not the mechanism that the Constitution itself provides for reform in the Constitution, the Constitution includes an article that says that if you want to reform the Constitution in full, you have to pass a constitutional reform bill and then hold a referendum. That's not the procedure that Veronica Mendoza wants to use. She wants to call for a constituent assembly to draft a new constitution from scratch. Now, you could simply, you know, modify the constitution to allow for a constituent assembly, which is not something that she's proposing. But I mean, you could jump over that obstacle through constitutional means, and I would have less problems with it. My real problem is, like I was saying, there is no party system in Peru. So unlike in Chile, I don't have any certainty or any confidence that our electoral system will be able to produce anything different than the kind of congresses that we have been producing. So the idea of a constitutional assembly is presented as this, oh, we'll bring together the brightest minds the country has to offer, and we'll bring together the most diverse group of people from all sectors of society, indigenous populations, women, minorities, and bring them together to draft a plurinational constitution. I have a lot of sympathy for the idea. I think their heart is in the right place. But I think the real danger with a constituent assembly model is that we will have a conservative constituent assembly that will make us go back in everything that we have gone forward with this constitution, which granted is the product of a coup, but it does give you something to work with. It doesn't ban same-sex marriage constitutionally. It doesn't ban abortion constitutionally. It does incorporate the state action in several sectors of the economy. There's a lot to work with the constitution. And I fear that we might risk going back by the mechanism that we're choosing. So instead of proposing a constitutional assembly and acknowledging that the constitution needs reform, I would say to either use the path that is more similar to what we do with codes, like the civil code or the criminal procedure code, they all have reform commissions, or have specific reforms in a more limited way, because I'm really scared of the prospect of an authoritarian constitution, even if I have a progressive president.
It's interesting how many times I feel like I've heard you use the word pragmatic, in that in other countries, I feel like when there's a moment of uncertainty or a lot of trauma in different ways, people tend to kind of more the ideological poles. But there is a sense in Peruvians, again, like you said, they just want the government to work. They just want something to happen. So as voters head to the polls, what are those top, I mean, they could pick any government service, I suppose, but what are those kind of top three services that you think people want to work, or that they would want the government to do in this next term?
Well, I think there's a difference between what the sectors that the population would want to fix and the the sectors that, if fixed, would satisfy the population most, because there's a level of technical detail there that sometimes escapes the general public. So people would want to fix corruption, security, and health right now. Health because of the pandemic, corruption because of the huge corruption scandals that Lavajato and all of this, the Vacuna Gate, and security because crime is a very big problem for all of the country. Those are the main things that will pop up in the minds of people immediately. Now, I think, in addition to those, because I don't want to say instead of, I think there is a big institutional reform that is necessary. This idea that you can remove presidents easily is very fundamental, even if it's not in the minds of everyone all the time. We need stability in government. I also think justice reform, like the way we select our judges, is very, very deficient in the country. And in general, the idea of the relevance that public spending has to have in these key sectors of health, education, and police, right? Those are the, I would say, the three aspects that most affect someone's life, you know, having an education, having health, and being protected. But it's not just about throwing money into them, it's about fixing the structures of these systems so that when you put the money in them, that money isn't squandered. And I guess that's the problem with some of the proposals coming out of Veronica Mendoza right now, that rather than focusing on this, they're focusing on having a state airline to transport vaccines easier. And I don't think anyone really cares about that.
So if you had a constitutional wand, what is one thing that you would change right away if you could?
So the first thing would be the interactions between the legislative and the executive, in the idea that the executive can dissolve Congress legally and the Congress can vacate, you know, kind of an impeachment of the president very easily as well. That needs to go away because politics needs to be a little bit more stable as you know, the foundational bedrock.
Yeah. And we'll say, I mean, that was, those two dueling powers were invoked about a half dozen times in the last 5 years. So it really marked this last term that we're coming out of. Well, I think that is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much. And again, we will hopefully have a chance to check back up after these general elections and before the runoff.
Amazing. Thank you for having me again.
Next up, the University of British Columbia's Dr. Grace Jaramillo tells Chase Harrison about the runoff in neighboring Ecuador.
Dr. Jaramillo, thank you so much for being with us today on the Latin American Focus podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So on April 11th, Ecuadorians will vote in the second round of the presidential election. In the first round, the top two vote-getters were Andrés Arauz and Guillermo Lasso. I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit about how each of these candidates brands themselves to voters and whether or not this is starting to change between the first round and the second round.
Well, just to summarize, I would say that the two candidates represent a long-standing, at least in the last 14 years, traditional Ecuadorian politics. The first one, Andrés Arauz, is representative of what it was called Revolución Ciudadana, although now he is running for a different party. The main brand he's championing and defending is the achievements and outcomes of the Citizens' Revolution led by Rafael Correa from 2007 to 2017. Albeit the current president, Mr. Lenin Moreno, was also part of that revolution. About 2 years ago, he completely disenfranchised and disbanded himself from that revolution and started a huge wave of reforms, not only politically, but also economic ones. Guillermo Lasso, it's also part of this old-fashioned conservative parties in Ecuador that are born in the coastal region, more specifically in Guayaquil, and they represent the economic elites of the country. And he is championing neoliberal economics, drastic reduction in the size of the state, and a more public-private partnerships, among others, in the social service delivery of social goods. So that is to summarize the difference between them, but there's a gulf between them in terms of not only economic values, but the vision that the state should be driven the economy, that is Andrés Arauz, and the private sector should be driving the economic development and success from Guillermo Lasso's point of view. What is probably paradoxical in both cases, both are social and cultural conservatives, which is they are not really championing women's reproductive rights. They are against legalization of abortion, even in cases of rape and incest that are widespread in the country. Ecuador has the second largest ratio of adolescents and teenage pregnancies in Latin America, and that is a real crisis that none of them are able to tackle head on.
Voters who might have different perspectives on the social issues you talk about, how did they express themselves politically in the first round of the vote?
Well, it turns out that the majority of the country really was a split not only between these two, but it was such a surprise coming into the first round because they leaned towards a Central Democratic Party that was long gone through a candidate that was a complete outsider, a small, medium entrepreneur that is an exporter, a famous exporter, Javier Herbas, that has a refreshing view with bringing on these all new women's rights, LGBTI rights, a vision on climate change. But probably the most surprising outcome of the first round was the ascendance of Yaku Pérez, the indigenous candidate that almost got into the second round, just short of probably two deciles of a point. And that was the real surprise, because if anything, innovation is in politics, especially on the progressive side, would come with an indigenous candidate that was championing a new ecology for water rights and a new vision anti-extractivism, but also was the most advanced in terms of social rights, women's rights, indigenous people's rights, and also LGBTI community rights. So that is just to summarize the surprises of the first round in a field that has 16 candidates, not less. So it was very difficult to predict anything. In fact, most of the surveys and polls done before the election went all wrong, except for the fact that all of them had Mr. Andrés Arauz winning the first round.
I'd like to talk about both Yaku Pérez and Javier Herbas, but maybe we'll start with Pérez. He only ended up missing the runoff by about 33,000 votes out of 10 million, so it was quite close. But since then, he alleged that there was fraud in the results. He led protests in the country. At this point, it seems like a chunk of Pérez's supporters might register a null or blank ballot. Do you think either Arauz or Lasso are going to be making a play for the Pérez voters specifically?
They are both making a pledge for them. They really want to attract those voters because they need them desperately in order to win the election. So they have already started conversations. They have started even to talk their language, especially when it comes to women's rights and gender issues that were so absent in both plans and candidacies in the discourse of both candidates. So they have already started. And the issue with Yaku Pérez voters are really the fact that one of them has a real disadvantage in the sense of the past experience with the indigenous movement. Traditionally, neither the conservative right nor the central left in Ecuador tried to drastically clamp down on indigenous movements and indigenous protests in the past, except during Rafael Correa's administration, with more than 200 cases of accusations of terrorism of indigenous peoples, on top of almost 900 people incarcerated or initiated trials against them just because of the act of protesting. So that is a real history that prevents the core of the indigenous movement and the indigenous party, Pachakutik, which Yaku Pérez belongs to fully support Andrés Arauz, even when he claims he has changed or he belongs to the progressive left. On the other hand, they cannot support Guillermo Lasso either, because for the indigenous peoples and Pachakutik, it's really damaging internally and in their platform to be really close enough to Guillermo Lasso being him a banker and and the best representative of the conservative right. So Pachacuti has really made a point in the last few days to call for annulment of the vote, to call out both options for the country as a farce, as really damaging for the future of the country. And that really will skew the possible results that either of them, Guillermo Lasso or Andrés Arauz, can have at the very end.
Nearly 10% of voters in the first round registered null ballots, which shows that there's a large segment of the Ecuadorian population that feels discontented with politics, the status quo, is looking for new options. A group that gets talked about a lot is young voters, voters under the age of 30. Xavier Hervás particularly did well among this group. And I'm wondering if either Lasso or Arauz is trying to reach out to these youth voters in the second round.
Both are trying to appeal to youth voters in the second round. I think, though, that Andrés Arauz will have more appeal to young people. First of all, because he's so young, he's just 36 years old. Second, because he is a refreshing face in Ecuadorian politics. Young people are not really used to his brand yet. They have benefited immensely from the funds in education, the scholarships established by the Rafael Correa administration that sent a lot of young people to study abroad in the best universities. And the number of people benefiting from those policies were about 10,000 or so. So it really permeates to many Ecuadorian families. And that will be a reminder to the youth that they have better possibilities with them. So in terms of policies, Andrés Arauz will have, I would say, more success with youth voters than Guillermo Lasso, that, believe it or not, he has also appealed to young voters using TikTok and dressing differently and dressing more in fashion with the ages and trying to be casual and improvising things like dancing and moves and even slang conversations that will be attractive in TikTok type of announcements. But I would say that regardless of the marketing styles that Guillermo Lasso implements, at the end of the day, he is more than 70 years old, and his appeal will not be as attractive as a young Andrés Arauz with just 36 years of age.
It's always fun to see a 70-year-old on TikTok. But social media has been a major tool for candidates and parties in this election, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, TikTok. I'm wondering if there's a marked difference between these two candidates in how they're reaching out to voters, whether they're relying on social media or maybe looking towards more traditional ground game organizing and mobilizing as we move to the second round.
Well, that is also a paradox of Ecuadorian politics, because it used to be an on-the-ground exercise of organization, canvassing, and big rallies across the country, especially in the big cities, in marginal neighborhoods, and so on. However, the pandemic changed everything for Ecuador. And I would say that the best position candidates, the four finalists of the first round, relied mainly on social media and TV and especially big media to advertise their cause and to promote their plans. In the second round, they have just racketed up to social media, and TikTok has become the best way of advertising and managing the appeal, especially to youth population that was left behind. Probably it's because the majority of voters that are young voted really for Javier Hervás and Yaku Pérez. So they know that the votes are there.
No matter which candidate wins, they're going to be facing a divided Congress whose composition was fully determined in the first round of the election. What can we expect from this Congress where no party has a majority?
Well, we can expect a difficult Congress, to be sure. A National Assembly that will be divided and will be bickering for every piece of legislation. That is what we expect. Andrés Mejía is an academic author who coined the term the ghost coalitions in Ecuadorian politics. And it has always been the case, institutionally and traditionally in Ecuadorian politics, to resort to this type of shadowy votes behind the scenes when there's always the guy with a suitcase full of dollars trying to buy votes in exchange for policies that are needed. And that is particularly true when you have to pass economic emergency bills that implies local taxes or federal taxes that will be very difficult when it comes to elections for these particular legislators. So at the end of the day, both candidates becoming president will be in dire straits. I would say it will be better for Andres Arauz because he has the largest bloc in Congress, and he will be willing to negotiate, especially with not only Alianza País, but also Javier Herba's party, Izquierda Democrática, who won a sizable number of seats, but also Pachakutik. I would say that it will be more difficult to Guillermo Lasso because he got the shortest number of seats within his coalition with Partido Social Cristiano, the traditional conservative party from the coastal region. So moving forward, in both cases, governance will be extremely difficult, and the chances of a transparent, broad, consensual coalition to govern the country are pretty much all but prevented.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Dr. Jaramillo. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Good luck.
Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis. This episode was produced by Katie Hopkins. To learn more about this year in Latin American elections, visit as-coa.org/2021. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. For more about upcoming concerts online, visit musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can help us spread the word by giving us 5 stars, writing us a review, sharing, and subscribing at Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.